And they brought us over with. They said, Jeff, hey, so we need to, I never can prepare anything. I don't know what I'm gonna say. It just has to come out something, that's for sure. But I am an alcoholic, and I had my last alcoholic drink the 8th day of May, 19 years ago last May. I like to say I'm going on my 20th year. I hope I'll make it. 2 weeks from yesterday, I'll be 70 years old, and if you think I'm going to tell you how much I weigh, you're crazy. I didn't start having a drinking last year. I am going to qualify a little. When I was a little doing quite a bit, but I didn't qualify. And then different things happened about not qualifying. For instance, a lady got, is that loud enough to go to the top out? My voice carries, anyhow. This lady came to me and she said that her little boy, I made a comment, I needed something about my drinking. And she said that her little boy said to her, oh, mother did that, and I was looking at the lady over the crate. This is a case that she said that I was too nice to drink wine. I'll qualify. Personally didn't think I'd ever become an alcoholic. In fact, I didn't know what an alcoholic was, because when they told me that I was probably an alcoholic, neither was I ever relieved, because I just thought I was just simply nuts and getting crazier all the time, because I didn't control this thing that was getting me down, and I had no control over it. I was so hopeless. And so when they said, boy, you thought I was an alcoholic, it was a relief. I had so many people say that that is a difficult part to them about this program, is admitting they were an alcoholic. It sounded terrible. Well, I had thought I had become a perfect drunk, and that a hopeless drunk. And as I say, then the word alcoholic certainly wasn't disturbing to me. I felt that if I was just straight, maybe I could do something about it. But this drinking, as I say, didn't start until later in my life, because my husband was an alcoholic too, and I don't say was. Most of you know he isn't living. To me, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. But he is living, and he drank heavily in our younger days, and I had said that I would never marry or have anything to do with a man that drank, because my childhood was a very unhappy one through my father drinking like he did. I was deprived of all the things that youngsters hold dear. I was the oldest of a family of seven, and very poor family, and I certainly never thought I'd make the mistake of getting mixed up with anyone that drank, but I did. I met my husband. I went to Indiana to visit Mass, and there I met my husband. He was one of the best families in the town, and no drinking connected with him except him. They were very strict Methodists, and his sister was a musician and played the organ at the Methodist Church, and they were deeply disturbed, though, because he certainly was the black sheep of the family. His father was a Civil War veteran, had lost an arm in the war, and he was in business there in a small village, insurance and real estate and so forth. And when Ralph was old enough, he took him in partnership. His wife and 18 sons, but mostly the son was out on a beam. And they, people would remark, they would go, my husband's father, I believe, was 53 when he was born. And they'd say, there goes poor old John, Uncle Roscoe. And there he was. They would be so disturbed about his drinking. And so when I went to Indiana, my aunt said that I could have dates at her house, but I couldn't, that was one fellow. And she mentioned another that I couldn't have dates with because he drank too much, but his family was a very fine family. But that was the guy I wanted. He knew the forbidden fruit, and he didn't always want. A 4 months after she had told me that, I had married the guy. And he didn't tell me he wouldn't drink, and he didn't quit drinking, that's for sure. He kept on drinking heavily, and we had two children, and it got worse and worse, and finally, before the second child was born, my husband's family decided to send us to a farm the other side of Redana, where my people live. And that stopped. That at least would stop this drinking and carrying on until after the child was born. Unfortunately, and instead of helping matters any, he and my father would go to Ravenna, and they had local option, I guess you call it there then, and they would take a streetcar and go to Falls, and get loaded together and come back, and they would have this horse and buggy or what have you there to drive home. And one of the instances of these things come back to my mind. My mother was very fond of my husband, even with his drinking, and exceeded more in him than he did in my brothers or my father. But this particular time, they had gone to town, and my young brother had gone with them. And he was trying to get them home, and this was, I guess, a thorough, whatever they call it, express wagon or what have you. But anyhow, my mother sent for a screen door. And my husband was in the back of this thing with a screen door, and I pushed his brother every time, a little while, you know, screen door bolts would fall out, and he'd have to try and get them back in. And then when my husband got home, he decided to help my mother, and he was a city boy, never had lived on the farm, but he was going to water the horses for her. And they had three, and he watered them over and over. And I remember he had very nice clothes, always tailor-made, and he had a light gray coat of one lovely tailored suit and navy trousers to another lovely tailored suit on. And he kept watering these horses, and they had one they called Blind Charlie. Well, my mother tried to tell him that she thought they had enough water, that he had her had them out many times. He just keep going over and over, finding old Blind Charlie living in the manure pile. And I went off to try and get him up, and he assured me that he had a hell of a lot better clothes for him than me, and he had on them, so I just forget it, and I believe he's going in the manure pile. I just mentioned that in the other day. But this drinking went on and on, and finally we were separated, and over his drinking, and I came back to Ravenna and went to work in the woolen mill, where I had went to work before I was 14, and brought my two children back to Ravenna with me. And in a year, he came back, and Mommy was taken back and said that he wouldn't drink again. He came in on the bunk. He had nothing but the clothes on his back, and he'd been doing line work then, and he had a safety valve and a pair of spurs. And I took him back and was glad to have him back, and he stayed alive for 15 years. And Dr. Bob, of my story, often said that that was an unusually long time for what he considered to a true alcoholic to be sober, just through fear of what I would do about it, that I wouldn't live with him. So after this 15 years, and we had moved from camp to Barberton. My husband was with the old Portage rubber company there before Sylvan took over. And he decided to go out. My oldest daughter had married and was living at home. And they went out to a prize fight, the son-in-law and my husband. And I never guessed that he never drinking again. I thought he was absolutely cured. For quite some time after he came back, every time he was a little late, I'd be pacing the floor and sure that he was staying drunk. But it didn't happen, and so I thought he was cured. And of course, I don't know how he didn't get cured, but this particular night, I had looked at the clock and thought it was quite late, and then I got up, and I thought I heard them, and I said to my son-in-law, "Where's Dad?" And he says, "He's coming," and he was. He was drunk and coming on his hands and knees up the steps. Well, that was when I made the decision. I guess it was a decision that I had been so very unhappy during this time that we were separated that I would go with him. And I told him so. I said, "Well, now, the youngest daughter was in high school, and the other one married, and if that was what he wanted, that's the way we do. I'd go with him, and what he drank, I'd drink." Well, that was a big mistake, because I could drink six times sometimes more than what he could drink. It just hit me like nobody's business. And, well, we had about 5 years of good companionship and a lot of fun, and just, but it was gradually worse, and I'm sure that I was, I don't know if you could call it worse, but possibly had a bigger capacity, and I always have said that women, I think, who have are shielded and don't have to go out to work can keep on drinking more easily than men can, who try to maintain some semblance of sobriety enough to hold their job. And I would take out, so I'd take him to work in the morning. I'd done all the driving, and I'd have a terrific hangover, because he always passed out long before I did. And then when he gets asleep and gets sort of sobered up, and I keep drinking the greater part of the night. People often, I hear these leads where they say that they were lone drinkers. Were you? And I said, no. drank alone and with anyone that had drink with me. And I would just say, well, I was a home drinker, were you? No, I was a home drinker and a broad drinker. I drank any further I could get something to drink and somebody to talk to. So I would have these, he often laughed because he said when he'd get up in the morning, I'd have these parties evidently that were my own. And I'd fry chicken and have beads all over, and I found apparently a whole set of silverware in the register after I got sober in AA, where I'd sit for the kitchen table and I suppose dropped chicken bones, particularly silver, down this register. And one of the funny things about it was that he said invariably the evening paper would be all spread out here where I'd eat the chicken and all these bottles, and he said invariably it was upside down. I had never been able to figure out why, who I thought I was bluffing by getting that paper like that and pretending I was reading because I was thirsty alone because he was passed out, but that was one of the crazy things I did. And I would get up and take him into work, and he'd be sobered up some, you know. If it was too bad, why, he wouldn't go into work because he never went in. He had a very good position. He was an electrical engineer, and it was very much dependent on him that the factory kept going. If they had a breakdown or anything, he had the men working for him who were, his men just loved him because he always went to bat for them. And they would carry on and cover up as much as possible. I know that's the only reason he kept the job that he had as long as he did. And so sometimes he didn't go in, but a lot of times I'd take him in. He would have slept it off pretty much, and I'd take him in, and oh, I'd have this terrific hangover. And I'd go right down to the joint and start pouring him into me, and sometimes it'd take five or six before I could keep one down. And then when I did, I'd be off to the races again. And many times when I went home, the humiliation would be terrific, even though I was drunk. I always thought I'll get this beer in the house some way without anyone seeing me doing it. And invariably, the bomb fell out of the sack in the middle of the backyard and flashed and crackled, and everybody, of course, in the neighborhood could hear it. I still have a bakery man, city bakery man, that comes out there. And he said how many times he drove in the yard and found me passed out in a car in the backyard, right in plain daylight. And, of course, the more humiliated and remarkable I was over it all, the more defiant I became. I wonder if many of us are that way. We finally lost our home in Barberton and moved out at where I live now. And we got movers drunk the day they moved us, and we had quite a splurge, so that the neighbors certainly had something to look forward to our living there. It means a great deal to me now that I have the respect for that community that I have, and I say this in a very humble way because it's taken a lot of doing, especially in my own mind, because I thought everybody knew even more than they did. Now, I wasn't like a lot of us drunk, but tell me, when you thought we were covering up and thought that we were doing a good job at it, I didn't. I thought everybody must know how awful I was drinking. And I know some people that live down the second house, some of them said somebody down in this little community said to him, I said, that woman over there drinks the way she does. And he said, well, I don't see how she could. She washed her car and worked out in the garden. And she's a hard worker. I don't see how she could put in much time drinking. But he must have not been watching too carefully. Many mornings I think I'll have a grand time in the yard this morning. And so I start out in the yard, and I had a lovely lawn and a lot of flowers. And I think I do wonders, but I can be out there a half hour so that old voice you know that goes on inside of you. Down the Adams and get a gallon there, you can work that up. Down the Adams just over and over. So I'd sit down there at Adams and take my jug and get a gallon of beer and have a few double headers on the side while they were filling the jug. And I'd go back and sit under the tree and have a grand old drink by myself. I'd blast at my husband in the afternoon at 3 o'clock. I was supposed to many times. I got way late. Think I'll just stop and have a couple of beers and get in a card game and arrive over there 2 hours maybe late tomorrow. Generally, I was given the privilege that I could drive in for him, which was quite a privilege for an outsider. And I invariably drove in when I couldn't hardly see where the gatehouse was. When we think of these things, how grateful we are that God surely must have been guiding us and been with us, because I think of all these privileges that I so balled up and showed so little appreciation for, and yet I got through them. Well, the first 5 years was pretty good, and the second 5 years I knew I was away. I didn't admit it, but I knew in my own heart that I had to drink. You know, it's a marvelous thing to get up in the morning and say to yourself, I don't have to have a drink today. And I still marvel at it that I can say that. I don't have to have a drink today, because it was always, I gotta have a drink. And if I wouldn't have it in the house, the first thing I'd think of was getting to a bar somewhere to get a drink. And we knew that he was going to lose his job if it kept on. You know, it just can't go on forever. And finally, when he threw out, we'd be on a drunk for several days. Why, he would say, no, I'll probably get it today. So he'd say, well, I'll call you. Now, I take the man's time up at 10 o'clock. I'll call you and see if everything's all right. So he'd call me, and I'd be pacing the floor, and he'd be in there shaking, expecting to get fired. And he'd call me, and he'd say, well, everything's okay once again. And that's something else I often think about as I go back. What kind of appreciation did he show? When I drive in for him, either he or I, one was as bad as the other, would say, Henry, we better go to the liquor store and celebrate that he was fired today. So we'd go in and we'd do it all over again, and that was the way he showed appreciation that once more we'd escape. And then it just got worse and worse and worse, and like it does for all of us. And it was more hopeless and more hopeless. Then this particular time of year, anyway, our vacation was always the first 2 weeks in September. And I was always had the car loaded on Saturday noon and ready to start on our vacation. And I was always well loaded by that time too, ready to start. And that was when the real trouble, as I figured, started. You see, we'd been under such a strain with this drinking and trying to save his job and trying to keep a semblance of something decent that when we were going on a vacation, why, then the bars were down and we had a load of liquor to take with us. And we got in all kinds of jams to start with. But then it became worse. Finally, I broke my arm. I still have the marks of it, and he didn't drive. I broke it at a little place up on a tea room up on the mountain, and all I had was tea that particular day for lunch. Of course, I had a bottle in the car, but it wasn't drunk. And they took it down to a little mining station. They took it back to Joel with the bone sticking out of my wrist down East Raynell, where they set my arm. And I went on the vacation driving with my arm in the cast, drove into Washington, and again I say how God ever let me get through, I don't know, but we did. And then the next vacation, I got picked up for drunken driving down in Bel Air. And that was something, because that's one thing hadn't happened to me. I thought I'd die. Never told that to anyone until I'd been in AA 2 years and told that I'd been pinched for drunken driving. Again, we come slinking back to town because it had been in all the papers down there. First woman drunken driver ever picked up in Bel Air. Mrs. R.M. Macy, a big letter, really. And my husband said then, now, if this gets back to Saturday, I'm finished. This will finish. Because they don't stand for that. So we come, I very dramatically told them. People, as they let us out after paying our $117, and they were going to escort us over to the bridge to go across the Wheeling, I should be very dignified. And I assured them that I hoped that if their wives ever visited Acton, I could show them the same hospitality they had shown me. Well, I've been the biggest one in the world, they didn't show me right back in a twink again, but I guess they were glad to get rid of us, and they took us over to the bridge, and we went over to Wheeling and put up at a motel over there and drank for another week so we could figure out of money. And then went from Lincoln back to Barberton. Well, once more we escaped. So well we were pretty much about it. So the next year we decided that we would stay home and we would really just drink sensibly. And we wouldn't get in trouble like that because that drunken driving charge, that was just awful. So we stayed home, and on Saturday afternoon of the day we'd be starting out, I set the house on fire. The inside of the kitchen was gutted, and we didn't even pretend then to sober up. We just drank and drank, and we had a furnace for hot dogs and so forth down the backyard, and we did, I guess, for a few times make some coffee out there, but we went on the whole two weeks that we didn't even sober enough to talk to the insurance man. So now by this time we know that we were drinking, don't we? And we were getting in trouble, and we were stressed, and we knew that at our age, that if he got fired, we'd talk about it, We say, if we're in the county house, it won't be the kids' fault, and we can't bring anyone but ourselves, because here was this good salary going. And now when I get off and work every day at my age, why, the most you gals could say, well, if Bill was after so forth and drank up all our money, I wouldn't be doing this. But you see, I drank more than he did. So now I say, get off and pitch, old girl. You've got to come and see them because you really get them. So I don't have that sort of thing. I just feel sorry for myself. But anyhow, finally, then we heard about my husband read about Ralph Hemsworth, and about that was the first he'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, a short time after he read that, I was in a bar, desperately sick, had a little hangover, and I couldn't raise the glass to my mouth, my hands just broke. And some guy in there told me that, I said to him, again, just defiance. Oh, I just defied the world to say anything about me being such an awful drunk. I often think about it, I was in a bar one night, and it's a wonder the woman didn't get slugged, because I must have been good natured that night. She says, oh, anything but a drunken woman, and especially a fat one. And the lady was a fat girl. The way she felt, but she didn't get slugged. But I was so filled up with defiance, and then trying to brazen it out, you know, and I said to this man, I got a drunk for that Alcoholics Anonymous if I keep on with this. And he said, well, sister, you think you're nuts now, you just join up again. He said, I can get you the password to get in. I know of some of them. But he said, oh, he told me that they hollered and rolled on the floor. And I thought, well, I'm crazy enough. I'm as well be crazy drunk as crazy sober if they do that. So, again, the chances must. I had to go race further down, you see, until finally I was so bad that, and I'd been in this other bar, and she had told me that, or I said to her, oh, I wish I could get off this. She said, well, my husband can show you how. She said he was a terrific drinker, and he joined up with something in aspirin that helped him. And I thought, well, that's that crazy bunch the other guy was telling me about. Well, I don't want any of that. But the time came that I did want it, and I, after a prolonged drunk, I got up off in the bed, dirty, disheveled, just, oh, remorseful, hopeless, and got in the car and drove down to his saloon and told her that if there was anything that he could use to help us to find a way to stay sober. And she said, well, I'll send him over. He came with two cans of beer, and that was the eighth day of May, 19 years ago. And I've never had drinks since, thank God. He said that the doctor that was at the head of this was in Florida. No, he said he lived in Akron and he went and seen. And I thought I'd die that night. I suffered so. And I thought, no, I don't dare. I thought, I've got to call somebody, a hospital or a doctor or something. And then I thought about this job that he had told about. So he came back the next morning and he said that he was in Florida, but they had sent him Barbican to a doctor who knew quite a bit about it and that he had sent us out some medicine. And so we sweated out and we paced the floor. And some of the boys that came told us that they had liquor in the car and thought if we asked for it or didn't need it off the bat, they would bring some in. But I guess they thought that we could get by, or we thought we could anyway, because we didn't ask for liquor. And we sweated out, and neither of us were housewives. And then we started at King School, which was the only group then. And we went there religiously for a year. We never missed a Wednesday night. And I just loved every bit of it. I, at first, I thought that the wives would look down on me, and they didn't. I just can't ever fail to give the wives so much credit. They were such a help to me, and I thought that probably they'd say, well, only Tracy's won those things, too. But the only thing that was said, and not in unkindness at all, they turned me over to Annabelle Gill, and she says, well, I understand you now, too. And I, instead of resenting it, I said, yes, that's what I'm here for. And we saw several different people that we knew. Coming down the aisle was my husband nudged me and said, look at that. And there was S.A. Sondering chauffeur. And he and I sat next to each other in our cars many times while he was waiting for S.A. and I was waiting for us, and talked. And little did we know that we both had hangovers or anything about that, of course. And here he was, too. And several of the people there that Ralph had been associated with, that he knew they drank. And we were very happy about it. We just accepted every bit of it that they told us. These men kept coming, and grouped us, two and three of them, and told us what it was all about. Tried to. I was just stupid about it as I could be. I didn't understand. I always think about, I like to tell new people, if you feel confused and you don't know what it's all about, just keep going to meetings and talking to people, because it'll finally show through. I have always been glad that I accepted the God that I found in AA, because I always believed, but I didn't have any church affiliation, and my people weren't church people. My mother was a good Christian woman, but I also felt that I found a God in AA in the very simplest way, and that I could talk to him in the simplest way. And it's meant so much to me. Many of you have heard me say that first summer in AA, and I'd be so confused, and I'd want a drink sometimes, and I'd go home and go to this garden that I planted, and there I learned to talk to God as I understood him. And he was a very simple God to me, and I talked to him just like I talked to a dear friend. And I also felt that I built up enough spiritual strength that summer and learned to talk to him the way I did, that when the time came that I had to have that strength, that it was there, and I had no desire to drink, because this beloved husband of mine was stricken with a heart condition. He was ill a year before he died, and we had 3.5 years of this wonderful life of AA. And he loved every minute of it. And during his illness, these AAers, as they, all of you are, proved such wonderful friends. I didn't know there was such friendship. I didn't know there could be such friendship. I often say to these beautiful orchids that I've had presented to me, I've never had a darn bartender in my life give me an orchid and all the money I've spent on them. And I've had many since I've been in AA. But after his passing, I knew that he never asked me, he had perfect faith in me, evidently, because he never asked me when he knew that he was dying, would I ever take another drink, or what would I do? I had this wonderful friendship that I had in AA to help me and give me strength. And I have learned to pray in a simple way. Probably not. I hear many of you say that you have regular time for prayer, or you have time for asking for help. I don't. I ask for it when I feel I need it. I do a lot of driving in my work, and many of my prayers are old hymns that I love that I sing. And it's a good thing nobody can hear them, because it's voice of mine. But nevertheless, it's a form of prayer for me. And when they first told me that my husband wasn't going to live, I couldn't accept it. I tried to gamble with this God that I had found, or bargain with him, I mean, and asked him to please not do that to me. That was the one thing I couldn't take. And he was given to me much longer than they expected he would live. And I think in that time, I built up strength enough to be able to say, thy will, not mine. It's a terrible one night, and I know you're all uncomfortable, and I'm not going to keep you any longer. If you want to ask any questions about how I stay sober, go ahead. I don't know if I can tell you or not. But thanks for listening this terribly hot night.
Thank you very much, Ethel, for a wonderful evening. The first time I ever got to hear you. I know a lot of your friends here may want to say something, so they're going to need to comment.
Well, I was a little late coming in tonight, but you've been an inspiration to me when I met you over at Dave's. Luke, kind of a social here tonight, and I've certainly got a lot of that garden stories you had about the way you found your God in simple ways.